Hey, this is Sunday morning, May 17th. This year's good. I mentioned the date. Sunday morning, May 17th, we're taking up our Every Day with God review. Last week for May 10th, got the schedule open here. We finished reviewing through 1 Chronicles 6. We did some of that Sunday morning, but in the material that I posted later, a day or two later, we finished through chapter 6. And so we're going to take up in chapter 7 this morning. And so let's do that in just a second. Let's start with a word of prayer, and then we'll get into our review. Our Heavenly Father, we're thankful for this opportunity now to think about your word and to consider what we've already read and to review it and to refresh and to renew in our minds principles and truths and practices that we see taught within your word. Help us not only to learn, but to be convicted by it and to be changed by it as well as we work to be better soldiers in your kingdom. We're thankful for those who are here and mindful of those who are not able to be here at this time for whatever reason. We hope and pray that we can do whatever we possibly can to reach out and encourage them. We ask that everything that we do during this class period and during our worship today, and indeed all day today and in all of our lives, will be done in a way to honor and glorify you. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. All right, so we finished through chapter 6. We're going to take up with chapter 7 in 1 Chronicles. If you've already read the material, you know that the first part of Chronicles is a huge, huge dose of genealogy. And that there's just a lot of names mentioned over and over again. But it's very important to understand why this is being done. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, Moses wrote that, the first verse of Genesis chapter 1. And he wrote that for a people who would be reading it long after the creation. Nobody in the book of Genesis read the book of Genesis. Why? It wasn't written during that time. And so that's, I'm not making fun of Adam and Eve and Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all the other great characters of faith that are there. But nobody read Genesis whose name is mentioned in Genesis. It was all written for generations after that. Well, why would you go back into the past to write something for generations in the present? Well, we do it all the time. We study history of all kinds in order to understand why we are where we are today based upon what happened in the past. And so if you're going through junior high school, college, one of the things that you're going to be introduced to is U.S. history or American history. How did this country get started? Who was involved in it? What were the processes? What were the difficulties that they overcome? And so in part to understand why we are where we are today, we go back a few hundred years to understand where those people were then. And so God does the same thing repeatedly. So the book of Genesis is written for generations after the fact. And so those people who read that would have an understanding of where they fit into God's plan. Exactly what's going on here. The people who are reading Chronicles are people who need to understand where they fit into God's plan. And in order to explain how they fit into God's plan at that time, there's a history lesson given. Let me tell you who our ancestors were. Let me tell you what our ancestors did and what they did right, what they did wrong, and why what happened to them happened, why they were punished, why they were blessed, and so forth. And in order to do that, Chronicles does something that you only see in one other book. It goes all the way back to creation. I mean, Genesis does that with starting with creation. Chronicles does that by providing a chronicle, a record of the genealogy of all those generations going back to Adam. And that's what Luke does in the lineage of Christ. It goes all the way back to Adam in Luke chapter 3. So that's unique. So as we get into chapter 7, what do we see? We see lists of chronologies generations and genealogies. And so we're not going to read through all of them. Opening verses, we see, talks about the descendants of Jacob through Issachar. Just a reminder, Jacob had 12 sons, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, and so forth, all the way down to Joseph and Benjamin. And we have 12 tribes that are listed. Joseph received a double blessing through his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. The tribe of Levi didn't inherit land, but they inherited cities. And so the genealogical record of all of those descendants of Jacob. So Abraham gave birth to Isaac, who gave birth to Jacob, whose name became Israel, became the name of the nation. And now you've got 12 tribes, each of which bear the name of the sons of Jacob. And so the genealogy is not only going to hit Jacob, but it's going to go through the genealogy of all those sons. In effect, what it's doing is making sure that nobody's missed. All of Israel's genealogy is going to be included, not just key figures. In the genealogy of Jesus, it's a straight line from Abraham through David to Jesus. Doesn't include all the other descendants because they're not descendants of Judah. And so because Judah was the kingly line, going back to the promise in Genesis 48, 49, 50 about the scepter not departing from Judah. But here it's not just a straight line genealogy through one of Jacob's children, Judah, focusing on the kingly line. It's everybody. And so the genealogy of Jacob through Issachar, next verses 6 through 12, Jacob's genealogy through Benjamin, through Naphtali, through Manasseh, through Ephraim, through Asher. So you're not just getting Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, jump all the way to David's seed line of Judah. You've got all the seed lines. So you have 12 independent seed lines of descendants of Jacob that are going to be addressed. So, and that continues. Chapter 8, first 31 verses of the lineage of Jacob through Benjamin. And so that's one of the smaller tribes, almost eradicated at the end of the book of Judges, repopulated through the circumstances that are spelled out there. So again, all of Israel's being addressed. I mentioned this before as we were looking at some principles from 1 Chronicles last time. 50% of Chronicles, 1 and 2 Chronicles, is duplication of material that you see in the books of Samuel and in the books of Kings. But half of it's new. And so we're going to see a focal point, not only now, but as we go throughout the rest of the text this week, and we're actually into 2 Chronicles still next week because of how many chapters there are in two books. We're going to see some unique things that are brought out there in the Chronicles, that there is a unique perspective, even though it's very, very wide-ranging. But one of the things we noted last week in our sermon was that Chronicles emphasizes all Israel. All Israel. Roughly 10%, no, more than that, 40%, I have to go look at the slide, of the nation of Israel was addressed. I'm going to do that very quickly because it's bothering me that I can't think of it. I didn't put the citation there, the quotes. But anyway, I think 400 times it's mentioned throughout the Old Testament text, and a large percentage of those are mentioned in Chronicles. The point is, it's emphasizing the united Israel, not just part of Israel, but all of Israel. And so that's an important thing to understand. So that's why you have the genealogy going through all of these different sons of Jacob. All right, so chapter 8, first 31 verses through Benjamin. 33 and following is the lineage of Jacob devoted to discussion of the descendants of Saul. Now, that's interesting. Saul is not the king line that's going to continue, but he was still a descendant of Benjamin. He was a son of Kish of the tribe of Benjamin. And so his seed line is going to be included. Why? All Israel. So everybody's genealogical record comes to the fore. So earlier this year, I finally sent off one of the test kits that one of my sons had given me, and it came back, and genealogical records can be confusing very quickly. And I'm just talking about one seed line. And so, you know, we found 1,700 people who are at least one generation connected to you, and then, you know, it goes, as you go further and further into cousins and second cousins and whatever, it gets huge, and I'm thinking, oh, this is crazy, you know, I can't comprehend all of that, it's too much to study. Well, here's what we've got going on here. It's not doing the whole world, but it's doing all of Israel to make sure that all Israel is going to be included in what's going on during the period of restoration, which is the setting for what's going on in Chronicles. Remember, children of Israel, northern kingdom captivity, southern kingdom captivity. At the end of the books of Kings and Chronicles, everything starts all over again. So when we get into the work of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, specifically in the works of Ezra and Nehemiah, and then in the latter prophets, Malachi and so forth, we're going to see there's a huge emphasis on redoing what Moses did hundreds of years before. And so how do you prepare them for that? Show everybody's involved, everybody has ownership, everybody in Israel is going to be included in what God's going to accomplish through that. So, seed line of Benjamin, then through Saul, who is one of the unique descendants of Benjamin. Chapter 9, verses 1 through 9 looks at the genealogy of the country of Judah, and of the country, and got a typo there, of Israel. There's a period at the end. Emphasis upon the settlement. So this is repeating some of the principles that we saw in Deuteronomy with reference to the division of land, some of which was predetermined by Moses before he died, but a lot of which was done after Moses died by his successor, Joshua. And that's spelled out in the book that bears his name, that is Joshua's name. Second section of that chapter details the genealogy of the priests. Remember, the Levitical priests did not inherit land in the same sense that others did. They inherited blocks of land scattered throughout the nation, but they didn't inherit one big continuous block of land. And so the Levites had territories scattered throughout the tribes, but the tribes generally, they inherited blocks of land. So this region belongs to Dan, this region belongs to Manasseh or Ephraim or whatever. The Levites lived in the midst of the rest of the people. That's by design, because of the influence that the priests were supposed to have in teaching the law to the rest of the people. So there are teaching pockets by means of Levite pockets scattered throughout the land. That's by design. So it's rehearsing that. That whole system is going to have to start up again. Let me just simply say, one of the things that's going to be addressed as you're going through the narratives of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, and then later, one of the problems that Israel had when they turned to idolatry was they failed to support the priests. Were the priests supported? The priests were supported by the sacrifices that were offered in the context of the tabernacle and then the temple, and by the gifts and the voluntary sacrifices that were offered and so forth, and by means of the temple shekel that was given, the contribution that was given. That's how the priests were in part supported. Now, they did have some lands, and they could have gardens and that kind of stuff, but when the priests stopped being supported, they had to turn to other means to be supported. And so Israel's failure to worship God appropriately not only affected themselves, not only affected God, but it affected that whole system of temple worship where the priests were going to be supported. And so that's going to be a problem that's going to have to be corrected as they're redoing everything when they come back from captivity. All right, so the Levitical priests and the different assignments that were made to them. Now, let me just mention this. You're going to see a huge, huge amount of detail that's spelled out in Chronicles about the courses of the priests. That's not classes that they took, but it was a work arrangement that was devised by David so that all the priests were functioning in a cyclical fashion. So the priests that lived in different parts of the nation, they would journey at different times coming to the city of Jerusalem and take their turns working in the temple. And so when you go to the book of Luke in the first chapter, and you see John the Immerser, John the Baptizer, commonly called John the Baptist's father, Zechariah, working in the temple, he didn't live in the city of Jerusalem. He traveled there to do his duty in the temple. And the estimates are, and I emphasize the estimates, that there were as many as 20,000 priests living at that time. So we are 1,500 years removed from the time of the institution of the priesthood at Sinai. And 1,500 years later, there's a huge, huge group of priests. And so they worked on a lottery system, and they worked in courses. You worked so many, you know, days doing such and such in the priest, and then you go back to the town that you came from. So there's a cycle of priests. There's an order. There's a work order of priests. David devised all of that.
You might not only get one chance in their entire life.
That's exactly right.
One specific time.
That's exactly right.
Zacharias was in Luke.
That's right. And so there's an element, a huge element of providence that he was where he was at that particular time when the angel appeared to him. And the likelihood is that he was never there again simply because there were so many priests to serve in order. So imagine you're working shift work, right? You know, my daughter works as a nurse. They do shift work. Police do that. Firemen do that. Sometimes they work 24 on, 24 off, and that kind of thing. And so they're not working all the time. Well, you can't have one guy working 24 hours a day, 7 days in a row. What do? Well, you rotate people in and out. So the system that's devised here that David instituted that's going to be in effect when John's father is working was how they rotated the priest. There was a certain order. So he was the order of Abijah, and there was a cycle of work schedule for those who were of that particular lineage to serve. But he wasn't the only one who was a descendant of Abijah. There were others. And so there's a cycle of that. All of that is determined in Chronicles. Let me simply emphasize this. We're going to see this somewhat in our lesson this morning in our worship. But David's influence on the future system of worship in the temple was huge. He never built the temple. But that didn't mean he didn't have any influence about what the temple was going to be and how the temple was going to be run after his death. And so Chronicles is going to chronicle all of that.
He puts it, he makes it available. He gets all the assets and puts it together before it can be built.
That's right. And that's one of the things that we're going to see as we talk about one of the unique characteristics of David. So he creates a spreadsheet, for lack of a better word, an organizational structure of who's going to do what and when. And that's addressed in very, very great detail. So when you look at this and say, well, it just talks about the assignments of the Levites, how much could there be? Just a reminder, they're no longer going to be in a tent. The most holy place is not 10 cubits by 10 cubits by 10 cubits. It's 8 times the size. It's 20 by 20 by 20. But then the size of Solomon's temple, which we already saw detailed in the opening chapters of Kings, is going to be huge. And so that's not a one-man job. That's not a two-man job. The priests were involved in a regular basis of offering sacrifices to the people who came from all places in the country to offer sacrifices. And so the priests were doing that nonstop all the time. And so that had to be organized. There had to be job descriptions given, assignments, and work details, all that spelled out. All right, last part of chapter 9 talks about the lineage of Saul that we saw introduced before. So it starts with Benjamin, and then there's a breakout talking about Saul. Why? Because Saul was the first king, and he was of the tribe of Benjamin. So he received special attention. So notice, even though Saul fell out of favor with God, Saul's lineage is included in the books of Chronicles to show all Israel is included. You may be descendant of King Saul, or you may be descendant of a larger tribe of Benjamin, and you may have been disheartened by what happened in the past with the men of Gibeah's sins and the almost total eradication of the men of Benjamin, but that problem is behind. You may be embarrassed that the first king wasn't the best king continuously, started out very well, but you may be embarrassed by the sins that you know of that are recorded in our books of 1 Samuel 13, 14, and 15, Saul's sins. But that makes no difference. Everybody's included. And so it's a total emphasis on Israel as a nation. Chapter 10. This is a repetition of the events that were depicted in the last chapter of Samuel. Just a reminder, as you're reading through Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, when you get to Chronicles, you might think, oh, I've read this before. Yeah, again, half of it appeared in Samuel in Kings. It's not exactly the same, but it's the same events, the same people, the same history. So if you're consistent in writing history, every time you write history, that's happened already. It's not all brand new. Why? Because the stuff that happened already is still the same stuff that happened when you write about it 100 years ago. 100 years from now. So if you're going to write a history of a great war, Revolutionary War, Civil War, World War I, or whatever, the basic facts haven't changed. New information may have come to light, but who was involved, when it started, what the details were, what the war was all about, none of that stuff changes. So if you're writing about the same stuff, the likelihood is you're going to see a lot of the same information. If you go to 5 different news sources, all of which are talking about the same event, the same person doing X, most of the stuff is going to be repetitive. Why? They're all talking about the same thing. But there are unique aspects of what we see in Chronicles that makes all the difference. And more about that is going to come out as we go further. So that talks about the death of Saul. Now, a reminder, when David became king, one of the first things that he does is he demonstrates concern for Saul's family. And he's thankful for those who, after Saul and his sons were killed and their bodies were unceremoniously displayed by the Philistines, one city takes the time and goes to rescue them. And David pays respect and homage to them, and then later his descendants. So that whole thing is showing that David's kingdom that's going to continue after Saul's and everybody unites around David still does not diminish Saul's impact. David shows respect for him, and as a result, God does. Remember, David constantly said, I will not take the life of God's anointed. Had opportunities to do so, but did not. All right, chapter 11. Now, let me just simply say this before we go too far. We are going to see from this point forward, after the end of the genealogies, that most of Chronicles is all about David and all about Solomon. You might say, well, they were only two kings. That's right. But they are emphasized because of how influential they were, not only during their lifetime, but how what they started during their lifetime is going to continue for multiple generations to come. And so the kingdom at that time, way before the period of in the intertestamental period, the kingdom at that time reached its zenith, its greatest territorial and physical geographical expanse during the time of Solomon. And so they are upheld as the paragon and the height of where Israel was. And so that's they are constantly reminded of that. You have been a great nation, as is typified and summarized by these two kings. So it's not saying there were no other kings. That's not what's the point. That's not the point. It's not saying that David and Solomon were perfect. No, that's not it at all. In spite of their imperfections, look how God made Israel great during their reigns. So it's a what God did during their reigns more so than what David and Solomon did during their reigns. So that's huge. All right, so when you get to chapter 11, the first section of the chapter repeats the account of the assumption, that is the coronation, the inauguration of David to be king. And so why do we have that all over again? There's never going to be a king sitting on the throne in Israel anymore. When we get to the book of Jeremiah, we're going to see that prophecy. The seed line continues, but the kings don't literally reign anymore. So why is it emphasizing what God did for establishing his kingdom? Well, because David's going to be central, not only in the huge political, military, you know, expansion that he was involved in, and how that's going to be maintained and even grown by Solomon. Let me just note this. Solomon's expansion of the kingdom was done more by business and politics than it was done by military expansion. David did the military stuff. David was the man of war. But Solomon was more the politician, more the statesman, more the deal maker kind of guy. In fact, many times during the reign of Solomon, you'll see that the children of Israel had rest during his reign, more so than any other. Why? Because of what his father had done before in dominating other nations. That continues, and Solomon's bringing in tribute from all kinds of people. And so David's reign is huge. As it develops what Israel is, it made Israel a real nation more so than they were before. Not saying that they weren't a nation during the time of Judges, but during the time of the Judges, there was a huge amount of tribal independence. We're the tribe of Ephraim, we're the tribe of Manasseh, and we're all about taking care of our land and our people, and yeah, we'll come together and help you on occasion, but this is us. And so the notion of kingdom is interesting prior to the first king. They are a kingdom, but they have no king. And everybody's pretty much out for themselves. And I'm not saying they didn't care about anybody else, but there's a huge sense of independence. When David becomes king after Saul, there's a dissension because some people don't trust David. And it takes a while for the king to be united under him. All those details are spelled out in the books of Samuel. But once it's united, there is a force that comes into play that didn't exist on the level that it did during Saul's days. Because David was more successful in vanquishing their enemies. And that sense of united all Israel that's mentioned repeatedly in the books of Chronicles, that goes back to what David's starting. So David is going to occupy a huge, huge, huge portion of the story in the narrative in Chronicles. It's not because of his imperfections. It's not overlooking those imperfections. It's because of what he did for the Israel as a whole, and especially what God did through him. One other thing. We are going to see, and we've already touched upon it, that the temple becomes a major, major issue in the writings of Kings when Solomon builds it. And we're going to see David's influence continuing in the temple even after he's dead. And so David's influence is militarily and politically oriented and geographically oriented, but in Chronicles, David's influence is more spiritually oriented. The emphasis on David's spiritual focus is going to dominate Chronicles. And it's going to dominate the first part of what Solomon did when he became king with reference to his devotion to God. Again, when we get into 1 Kings, first 10 chapters are fantastic. David's devotion to word and David's devotion to worship, or Solomon's devotion to word and worship. But it falls apart later. But the temple that he started, that influence is going to continue. All right, so repeats the assumption of David. Next part of the chapter details the capture of the city of Zion. And so it had not been the people that were there, the Jebusites, the town of Jebus, had not been displaced. And so they acted like nobody could ever defeat them. But during David's time, he captures the city of Jerusalem, and it's going to become the center of Israel politically, militarily, but also especially when the temple is going to be built there, religiously. But it starts even before that. It starts before that because David wanted to build a house for God. He's not going to be allowed to do so. And it's David that has the ark brought into a new tabernacle into the city of Jerusalem. And so Jerusalem is going to become a very, very significant place. Let me mention something that's interesting. In Joshua 24, Joshua tells the children of Israel in verse 14 and 15, he says, choose this day whom you're going to serve, but it's for me and my house we're going to serve the Lord. Well, the word choose there comes from a Hebrew term, bakar, which means to choose and to choose exclusively. All right. When you cut into something, we use the word incision. When you make a decision, you cut something off. And what you cut off, you put away, and you stick with what remains. And so when he says choose, it's kind of like that Latin term decision. You cut something off. It means you choose this, and you choose this exclusively. And that's brought out in that passage when Joshua told the children of Israel, we're going to serve the Lord. And he said, and they said, we're going to as well. He says, well, let me remind you what that means. And they said, we're still going to serve the Lord. He says, if you mean you're going to serve the Lord plus idols, then you haven't decided. You know, you can't stand up on your wedding day and says, I take you, Susie, to be my wife, but I got 10 other girlfriends. That's not a decision. That's a mistake, right? And so when God says, choose me, he doesn't say, choose me plus, you know, a pantheon of other gods. And so Joshua calls them out on that and says, no, if you choose God, it's a choice for God and God only. Now, why do I bring that up? Because that same word of choice is used with reference to God choosing the place where his house would be. God chose Jerusalem, and only Jerusalem is that place. And that's going to be problematic as you go through the books of Kings and in other of the prophets when we get there, because many other people decided to worship God all over the map. And God says, never decided to do that. And so when Josiah's reform came about, he got rid of all that stuff, got rid of all the pagan places of worship, got rid of all the places to worship God away from the city of Jerusalem, and saying, this is where it's supposed to be done. It's in Jerusalem. That was still a Jerusalem-centric thing, even during the days of Jesus. When he was talking to the woman at the well, she'd say, our fathers worshiped God in this mountain. And where they were in Shechem, in Samaria, the hill of Gerizim, one of the two mountains, the Mount of Blessing, Gerizim, and Mount Ebal, Mount of Cursing, was visible. And she said, this is where we worship. And Jesus said, well, you don't know what you're doing. This is, but she said, you say the Jews are supposed to worship in Jerusalem. And that's right. Why? Because God chose that. Like Joshua said, choose God. God chose Jerusalem. And so the significance of Jerusalem goes back to David's conquering of the city, David's moving of the ark into the city, and David's intention, though he didn't get to act on it, to build the temple. That's going to continue.
Jesus also said that they're going to worship beyond Jerusalem.
That's correct. There's a day coming when it makes no difference where, as long as you, but the principle of how you do it, still in spirit and truth. The location is not the issue anymore. And it's not the people who are exclusively Jews, but it's all people who will be God's followers. So that becomes a huge, huge, huge issue. Why are we going back into history and talking about David's conquering of Jerusalem? Because of what it means now. What it means now, because now the people who are reading Chronicles are the people who came back from there, from captivity, northern captivity, southern captivity, and they're starting things all over again. Just a reminder, this is the place God chose.
Big picture.
This is the place that God chose. And in order to show them how that happened, David moved the ark. David, captured the city. David planned to build the temple. Solomon built that the temple's gone. But when you redo everything, you are redoing it in the same place. Same place. So the foundation may not have been literally on the exact same spot where the first temple was, because it was destroyed when Nebuchadnezzar conquered the city for the final time, laid siege to it and destroyed it in 586, 20 years into the captivity. But it's the same place. In this mount, this is where it was, where it all started, and this is where it's going to continue. So that's a huge, huge deal. Chapter 11, last point there, number 3. Conclusion of the chapter contains a listing of the mighty men of David. And again, notice it's a hugely David-centric text to this point. Solomon's going to come up later. Why? Just to show how God had blessed Israel during David's time. So there's an expression that's used in the Old Testament. It talks about the sure mercies of David. But the sure mercies of David weren't David's only. The mercies that God demonstrated to David and through David were on a national scale. And everybody was blessed because of that. So let me simply note that every time God does something to bless somebody or does something to act in any way, all sorts of people are blessed. And so what God did for David wasn't just blessing David, it was blessing the nation. And so that's a huge thing. These people were still basking in the residual blessings that God initiated during David's time. Not just for David's sake, but for all of God's people. And that's just a huge thing. That's just a huge, huge, huge thing. All right, so again, a very David-centric text. All right, chapter 12. The entire chapter contains descriptions of David's armies. And again, you might say, why all of this stuff now? There's not a king, a descendant of David, sitting on the throne. But it's a reminder of what God has done. It's a reminder of what God has done in order to give Israel hope about what God will do presently and will do in the future. If you've ever seen any kind of commercial for financial things or seen any literature, you often see a disclaimer. You know, past performance is no guarantee of future results. All right? All the time. We made a gazillion dollars yesterday, but we're going to lose it all tomorrow. That's not what they say. They say what we did yesterday doesn't prove we can do it again today. Well, when God does that, when God said, this is what I did yesterday, he does that in order to confirm to people, this is what I can do today, and this is what I can do tomorrow. And so God's past acts are a measure of what God can do presently and what God can do in the context of the future. Reminder, when Gideon was first approached about being a judge back in the book of Judges, one of the first things he asks is, he says, I want to know where the God is who used to take care of our people like he did during the time of the wilderness. You gave us food, you protected us from our enemies, our clothes didn't wear out, all that good stuff. And he acted like you haven't done that exact same thing today, therefore you're not with us. Which is interesting is, in that context, God was choosing him to be a deliverer. Maybe not on the scale that he chose Moses to be a deliverer, but God's going to act through him to be the deliverer. And he's asking, how come you're not doing these things? So because God doesn't do the exact same things in the exact same ways, doesn't mean God's not acting. God still acts in the course of history, a lot of it providentially behind the scenes or through the agency of others. And so God was still involved. So as you read through this chapter, you see a huge emphasis on David becoming king, David capturing the city, and then a listing of David's mighty men, and so forth, and then all of his armies, right? So we get into chapter 13, and here's where we will slow down as we're going a little bit further. In this context, chapter 13, there's a repetition of what David did going back to 2 Samuel chapter 6, in which he intended to move the Ark of the Covenant to the city of Jerusalem, to a tabernacle that he had built. Now, all those details of that tabernacle are not spelled out in that context. The point is, there's an emphasis there about God changing the place of worship from where the tabernacle had been for many years. Initially, it was in Shiloh. Remember, the ark was captured when the children of Israel took into the battle against the Philistines. It had been in Kirjath-Jearim in the house of Amminadab for many, many years. David went to move it, and in the context of moving it, Uzzah reached out to touch it, and he died. David's thinking, what in the world happened here? My good intention has been thwarted. I wanted to move the ark Now, what's interesting is when we get into Chronicles, in 1 Chronicles 13, the details are spelled out as to why it happened. When it happens in the context of Samuel, the same details aren't given. So notice, it's the same historical event, but some details are added in this chapter that's not mentioned in the first one. So if you look at 1 Chronicles 13, David consults all of his men, his thousands and his hundreds and all the leaders, and then he says, want everybody to come together, and we're going to go to the place where God wants us to meet. Notice in verse 2, if it seems good to you, if it's of our Lord, let's send out men everywhere, left in the land, Levites in their cities, their common lands. Let us bring the ark of our God back to us. So they had been in an isolated place for a long time. And he says, this is a good thing. So notice, David was in the middle of all of his military conquests and that sort of thing, but David was still concerned about worship of God. He says, we need to restore what God had initially started back in the days of Israel at Sinai. So all the congregations get together and say, this is what we're going to do. So he gathers everybody together, and he goes to Kirjath-Jearim, verse 6, and he goes there for the purpose of bringing the ark of God, who dwells between the cherubim, where his name is proclaimed. So they're going to carry it on a new cart from the house of Abinadab. That's where it was. Uzzah and Ahio, that's A-H-I-O, not O-H-I-O. And David and all Israel played music before God with all their might, singing and so forth. And when they came to Chidon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to hold the ark and stumbled, and he struck dead. And David's angry, verse 11. What in the world's going on here? David was afraid of God. Notice this, saying, verse 12, how can I bring the ark of God to me? This is what I wanted to do, and this is what I started to do, and it didn't work. And so it says David could move the ark into the city, but it went into the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. Notice he's not a Jew. And it's going to stay there for 3 months, and God's going to bless him. So now, in chapter 14, which we're segueing into, it talks about the relationship that David and Hiram had. Hiram was the one who had supplied workmen and materials and all sorts of things for the construction of his own houses. And he's going to provide the same things for everything relating to the temple. So they have a very good working relationship there. And so during this time, the Philistines are going to be defeated. And he goes up and fights against them, and he's constantly defeating all of these nations and so forth. And then we get to chapter 15. And so more of his victories are spelled out, which simply says David's consolidating the territory. So what happens when we get to chapter 15? What was introduced in chapter 13, we go back to. What happened in 13? The move from the ark to the city of Jerusalem was stopped. All right, it was stopped. So when you go back to continuing in 1 Chronicles chapter 15, there's the attempt to move it again. Only this time, there's a major lesson that's learned, and we see something here that we didn't see before. So look at verse 1. David built houses for himself in the city of David, and he prepared a place for the ark of God and pitched a tent for it. Then David said, no one may carry the ark of God but the Levites, for the Lord has chosen them to carry the ark of God and to minister before him forever. So he gathers all Israel together. They're going to bring the ark of the Lord to the city of Jerusalem, to the place that he prepared for it. He gathers all of the descendants of Aaron and the Levites. That's verse 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. All of these he's gathering together. In verse 12, he says, here's the preparation you have to go through. Sanctify yourselves, sanctify your brethren, so that we're going to be prepared to bring up the ark of the Lord God of Israel to the place I've prepared for it. Now watch verse 13. Here's a key thing. For because you did not do it the first time, that is, didn't do it in the right way the first time, the Lord our God broke out against us because, watch the language here, we did not consult him about the proper order. Good motivation, good intention, we're going to move the ark back to Jerusalem in a special place that I prepared for it. Nothing wrong with the intention, but you know what the road to so-and-so is paved with. Good intentions. The issue is, what he wanted to do was good, but how it was carried out wasn't what God wanted. And that's why David was angry. I have a good intention to move the ark here. How can this be that this man died? And so there's the interruption of 3 months when the house, the ark remains in the house of the Gittite in Obed-Edom. And so now he realizes, we didn't do it the right way. Now they're going to do it the right way. So everything is appointed. It's going to be carried not on the ark, but it's going to be carried by the Levites. Notice it says in verse 15, on their shoulders by his poles, as Moses had commanded according to the word of the Lord. So that was how it was to be transported. So the initial means of transport wasn't done right. And so that's why what we see happened back in Samuel and what was recorded in 1 Kings, 1 Chronicles 13, that's why it took place. So now they do it the right way. All right. And so when they did that, they brought the Ark of the Covenant and they finally bring it into the place that David prepares for it in the city of Jerusalem in the next chapter. So notice, why is this mentioned all over again? You know, the writer of Chronicles could have just said, let me just remind you what happened to Samuel. Remember that whole incident and be done with it. But it's a slow, drawn out process over multiple chapters to show that God's intention and David's intention to have the Ark moved had to be done in a way that the intention was met with a proper protocol, that it was done not just with good intentions, but with good actions along the way. And so that's a huge part of this story that's brought out in this context. Why so much time? Because it sets the stage for the detail that God wants when the temple is going to be built. Now, it's already been built back in Kings, but it's being retold again for a new generation. The law was given a second time in the book of Deuteronomy to a new generation. The whole temple-centric worship is being retold a second time for generations far removed from when it first started during the time of Solomon. So, if Solomon reigned in the mid to earlier 900s, and we're talking about the restoration of these things in 536 and following when they come back, it's not till 516, 20 years later, that they actually build it. 400 to 500 years have elapsed since the temple was built. And it's been gone for 70 years, and now we're 20 years after that. No, it's 70 years total. It was 20 years it was occupied, 20 years later it was destroyed, but now it's gone. So how do they do it? Let me tell you all over again how you have to do it. And so the principles that are brought out in how the ark was transported to the city of Jerusalem are going to come into play about what you do when the temple is constructed. Same principle. Do it the way God said. That's it. Just do it the way God said. Does that mean that God doesn't love people and because he's so specific about what he wants? No, it's because he does love people that he's told them exactly what he wants. There's no question. All right. God doesn't leave what he wants to question. Sometimes he says, here's some specific details. If he gave a generic command, said, just build me a place of worship, do whatever you want, that would have been fine. But that's not the details that we see. And we're going to see more about that as we go through the writings of Chronicles, that the specific plans for the building of the temple were given to Solomon by his father David. All right, so what started in chapter 13, chapter 14, there's a break. Chapter 15 picks up again, and this time we see that it happened. That is, what happened to Uzzah happened because they didn't do it after the due order. So now they're going to finish all of that, chapter 15. And chapter 16, they finally get it there. So 13 it starts, there's a break in 14, and then 15 and 16 it comes back to it. Three new chapters are devoted to doing it the right way, even after this was already recorded in the writings of Samuel. So chapter 16, the ark comes into the city. They're going to place it in this tabernacle that David had made. And the second portion is a writing of the Psalms, which we will see repeated in the book of Psalms. All right, and it talks about the covenant that God made with Abraham. So the covenant with Abraham was hundreds of years older than the law. And so it takes precedence from the standpoint of establishing a principle that was still going on. In the context, and this is not to compare again, but in the context of making decisions, the Supreme Court often acts based upon precedence. What's that mean? Well, this is the way we've done it before, and we're not going to undo the law, so that sets a precedence. And so the precedent that was established when they moved the ark to the city of Jerusalem is going to be in good stead until we get to the time of the Christ.
How it was originally moved, and here hundreds of years later, how it's to be moved.
That.
It never changed.
That's right. The principles never changed.
God didn't change his idea of how it was to be moved.
Right. And just because they didn't know didn't mean that God had changed the rules. All right. And this is what's so striking when you get to Josiah in the end of 2 Kings and later in Chronicles. They discover the book of the law of the Lord in the temple. And the question is, how did it go undiscovered for so long? We're not told.
Just because it doesn't spell it out doesn't give us
does not give you the latitude to change things. Good point. All right, so notice the emphasis here is that these principles go back to the covenant that was established not just at Sinai with Moses, but also all the way back to Abraham. And the last section is more details about all the appointments that David established for the order of how things were going to be done in the context of the temple worship to come. So again, David's long dead, Solomon's long dead, Moses is long dead, Abraham's long dead. All of those things, however, all those individuals and the principles that are brought out during the course of their lives and the revelation that relates to their lives comes into play hundreds and hundreds of years later to reestablish what they did going back to the tabernacle worship in Sinai and back to the temple worship in Jerusalem during the time of Solomon. It's a do-over, but there's not a new manual. There's not a new way. It's the old way. It's the old manual. It's based upon the plans that God's going to reveal through David that's consistent with what he revealed to Moses. Nothing has changed in that regard. Hundreds of years have changed, but God's will hasn't changed in that regard. And so the children of Israel during the time of the period of restoration have to be convinced that what worked then will work now. The reason why they failed was because they didn't work according to what God wanted. Why did the nation fail? You didn't do what I asked you to do. Why did the nation fail? I told you not to worship any other gods, and you did. Why did the nation fail? Because they kept worshiping God, in part, but they added everything else that they wanted to. And sometimes, as you're reading through the book of Judges, it'll say that they just totally stopped worshiping God. So, God only, and then they added lots of other gods. And that continued, God called them task, and it got to some points where they said, we're not worshiping God at all anymore, it's just all the other gods. So they moved totally away. God told Solomon what to do. Solomon did it for a long time. But then later he starts moving into allowing support for his wives who were involved in pagan places of worship. And things went downhill from there, even to the time of Manasseh, who actually moved false pagan systems of worship into the temple that Josiah later had to get rid of. So, you know, what those individuals did became a pattern for the nation. So the pattern for the nation that's being restarted has to go back to what it was when it worked. And it's David-centric because of David's emphasis on doing things when he learned the right way. And that principle still stands. George?
Nehemiah had records that he could go back and start this over. And God knew that, and God allowed it. In 70 AD, God makes it in totality. There is no record. There hasn't been any record for thousands of years now. And they couldn't reconstruct anything if they even tried. And it's an empty religion, as far as I'm concerned, to start, because they can't do anything. And even in this case, if they even found this ark, how could you move it?
No priests that could be identifiable.
So if you start thinking about the total of it, I mean, and see how totally God did these things and why, and what it did today as far as the morphing of Judaism into Christianity and how it works today is just amazing. Just to look at it.
You mentioned Nehemiah, and we're not there yet, but we're going to get there after we finish Chronicles reading through Ezra and Nehemiah. The work that Ezra did, who was a priest, who was skilled in the law, during the time of Nehemiah, we see him referenced in both places. One of the first things he did when he gathered everybody together was they read from the book of the law, and they read all day long, and they gave it in such a way that it could be understood, and the Levites worked among the crowd to make sure that everybody understood everything. But they started not with a new law, but with the law that was initially given during the days of Moses. And so, again, repetition of what worked then, we're going to do it all over again. If it worked then and God was pleased, then it could work now and God would be pleased. What happened in between? You didn't do what God wanted you to do, and so God was displeased.
We don't have any record beyond the New Testament that God has changed his mind yet.
No. All right, we're going to stop there in chapter 16 for this morning, and I'll take up in creating a continued review. I'm going to go back very quickly to our daily Bible reading schedule. Last time we finished through chapter 6 of 1 Chronicles, and we are going to be ready for, let me see if I get to next week, the 24th, 2 Chronicles 25. Now that's wrong. I jumped 2 weeks ahead. For today, we should be at the end of chapter 29. So we'll do another 10 or 12 chapters review that I'll post later. That will bring us up to where we are in our reading. So we did about 10 chapters or so. We have several more chapters to do to bring us up to where we were. So we'll take up then next time with where we left off here in this chapter. In 1 Chronicles, we're going to take up with chapter 17 and cover the next 10, 11, 12 chapters there. And note a lot of details that are going to be spelled out about how the temple was to be built. Even though David wasn't going to be built it, we're going to see that it was still very much David-centered project. All right, thanks for your time and your attention. We'll stop now and get ready for our period of worship.